Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com.
Time to take a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. So if you have something maybe ailing your pet, your cat or your dog or whatever, you can join in right now at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, welcome back.
It's nice to be back.
Great. And you always bring some of the most interesting little stories.
Well, between visits, I tend to, I have my a little file of, you know, this is would be something to bring up on Larry's show. And, you know, this is something, I'm showing it to Larry. Here we are in the radio. But if you picture a miniature version of a front-loading washing machine, and it's a litter box, and it's called the litter robot. And the cat climbs in, and once it gets out, there's a sensor, and the thing spins and flings the waste into a holding area so that you can pull out a drawer and empty it later. You know, get a scooper. Buy a litter box. And you know what even makes better litter boxes? The storage tub type things, the shorter sided ones, because they're cheap, they're big enough. Remember, litter boxes need to be about 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to butt. This thing's tiny. I went online and they actually have a whole program we can watch it work, and very tiny litter holding area, and it costs $300. So, I think that would pay for a lot of litter and a lot of storage tubs. So, yeah, go easy. You know, just don't get the fads for your cat. They don't like them.
All right. And we've got some more. We'll sort of string those out through the course of the show. And Lori in DePere is up. Let's go to Lori. Hi, Lori. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Yes, we have a little 4-year-old male schnauzer named Wally. And Wally experiences a condition every now and then, unpredictably, where he is spooked by something.
Mm-hmm.
We're not sure what it is or what brings it on. Our son-in-law tells us that every time Wally is spooked, the fish are jumping and they practically jump in the boat. So we think it's something related to the weather or pressure or
Yeah, and sometimes it's really, you have to be a private investigator to be able to figure out some of these cases, unless it's something very clear, like thunderstorms going off. And many dogs that are storm phobic will start predicting that the storm's going to happen earlier and earlier as they realize when the sky starts to darken and the wind picks up, and who knows what they're responding to. I had a client in the other day with a dog, and they said, we want to rename him Doppler because he's our early weather detector. So whether Wally is reacting to, something in the environment, it's really going to take, it could be an odor, it could be sounds that maybe you're not even able to pick up on, minor things. Big thing, though, is give him a safe place to hide out. Don't coddle him, because that's just going to be reinforcing the behavior. And think about if this is happening often enough, and especially if it's mild, there's a pheromone for dogs called DAP, dog appeasement pheromone, now available in a collar form where your dog can walk around in this pheromone haze that imparts a sense of calming. And it's safe. It won't hurt him. Put it on, see if it makes a difference, and then just, get your little notebook out and start thinking about everything that's happened right before the event.
Carry a barometer around with
you. Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks for calling. Julie in Minneapolis, hi to you.
Hello. Should I explain what's going on?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. One of our three cats, we're driving through Wisconsin on the highway, and one of our three cats is practically drooling and salivating, and he's not comfortable driving, but I'm wondering if we need to be worried about him.
Well, many cats will drool and salivate when they're nauseous. They can also do that when they start to get upset about something as well, and just when they're frightened. My guess is that unless he's like meowing and carrying on, it may just be that he's feeling rather nauseous. And you may ask your veterinarian. I don't know if you're on the road right now or where you are. But
are you on the road right now?
Yes.
And okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, the big problem is, what are we going to give to your cat? You're not near your vet clinic. And ideally, most of the drugs that we do use that are antiemetics are prescription drugs, and you'd have to have a patient-doctor owner relationship to be able to get something like that prescribed. You can use over-the-counter antiemetics, you know, things that help stop motion sickness, things like Dramamine and Bonine. But I don't want to be the one to tell you to use that because I'm not your vet. I don't know your cat's health history. If you can, call your veterinarian and ask them what they can do, and they can pull your cat's record out, look at the cat's weight, and maybe able to give you something that you can stop at a local drugstore and pick something up for your cat to make them feel better.
Okay, great.
That's
Thank
a good
you
idea.
Very much.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. Thanks a lot for calling. And Mark in Rockton, Illinois. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. It's Rockton, Wisconsin.
Rockton, Wisconsin. Sorry.
It's okay. Challenging situation. I know this can be. I have a male and a female that are about 2 years old, cats.
Okay.
And never have had two cats more bonded to each other. They just really relish playing and cuddling.
Good.
And yeah, it's a really a nice thing because I've had cats that didn't get along so well. And a nice event in my life, I'm going to be combining my life with my fiance's, and she has about a 4-year-old cat who's always been alone.
Ooh,
and
okay.
So what are the challenges? And I know there are many different prescriptions for how to combine cats and trying to make sure that they're not insecure and
Well, the big thing is to go slow when you bring, you know, and you could even start right now with exchanging odors, like having towels and things that the cats may have slept on, and take them over to your fiance's house and vice versa. But when you do finally decide to merge, you need to make sure that you go about it extra slow. We have the cats set up in their own little efficiency apartments where they have their own litter boxes, food bowls, and they can be comfortable and get used to one room of the house. And, you know, eventually what will happen is you will start letting the cats out while one's still confined, and then your two are put away, the other one's out, and they just get used to the fact that there's another cat in the house. They can smell it, they may be able to hear it, there may be little paws under the door, and over time, as you start seeing them being able to walk past the room that you know, cats are confined to, and they're not hissing or growling, and they're showing some curiosity, open the door a crack, let them see each other during a pleasant event like meal feeding. I mentioned this pheromone for dogs called DAP. There is a pheromone for cats called Feel Away, also known as Comfort Zone for cats. And it now comes in little towelettes that you can wipe on the cats. But I actually like the atomizer, the thing that plugs into the wall so that the cats are living in this pheromone haze, as we I've mentioned earlier. So that might be something to consider trying. But you want to avoid the fighting, because once one fight happens, then they start anticipating that's going to happen, and you may get cats reacting defensively. So you want to avoid, you know, just throwing them together and saying they'll fight it out, because they won't, and it'll just keep getting worse.
We kept our two cats apart for five or 6 months before we got them together. We actually put at one point we had one of these baby gates.
Yep.
In between there.
And, you know, cats aren't vertically challenged, and they can jump over that pretty easily. I've actually installed screen doors, just an inexpensive one of those, you know, ones that you can get at a hardware store. Just replace a door on a bedroom with a screen door so that they can see each other, but they can't get at each other. Sometimes patio doors work. If you've got a three-season porch, you can have a cat outside and they can see each other through it. But even that may be too much stimulus for the cat.
How long do you think they should be separated?
It varies. It can be anywhere from days to, as Larry said, months. And, you know, if you've gone 6 to 8 months and you have not been able to get them past the point of seeing each other without hissing and growling, there may be a problem. And so then you may be looking at living in a house divided. but other things you can do, really expand your vertical space. Allowing cats to have areas that they can get up on and rest on makes a small room seem much bigger to them. So ramps along the wall, cat trees, resting areas like the little window seats and things for cats, really helps, you know, make it a lot less stressful for them. And remember, three cats, you're going to have at least four litter boxes in four different locations in your home. So think about that, too.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Diane in Milton, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 12-year-old dog who is perfect in every way, except she has a chronic problem with crust and mucus on the very end, on the sides of the end of her nose.
Okay.
And I have used an antifungal to clean it. I've used an antibacterial to clean it. I've used a combination to clean it. And nothing seems to take this away.
Yeah.
She does have one behavior that we don't like, and that is she likes to eat the droppings of rabbits and deer.
Okay.
And I wondered if she maybe, if that was the problem.
Very unlikely. Does she have normal eyes? Her eyes aren't dry at all? She has normal tear production? You're not seeing any crustiness around her eyes?
No. She does have dandruff, though.
Okay.
She has dry skin.
Yeah, there's a condition that dogs have where you'll see kind of crusting and, you know, skin change around the edge of the nostrils. That's called discoid lupus, and it's an immune-mediated problem that is actually fairly common in dogs. And if you've not taken your dog into the veterinarian for evaluation, the way you can get a diagnosis of that is via biopsy. I know that sounds a little extreme, but the fact that you're trying all the common things, keeping it clean, antibiotic ointments and things.
Well, these were actually recommended by veterinarians.
Okay.
The treatment.
Yeah, but, you know, go ahead and look up discoid lupus or have your veterinarian look that up, because you will see that's how they usually present, with kind of loss of the structure around the edge of the nostrils. It's very common immune-mediated problem, and I think you may need to go back to the vet and say, it's not getting better. Mm-hmm. What do you think about this as a diagnosis, and can we maybe get a biopsy done?
And how do you spell the first word?
Discoid, D-I-S-C-O-I-D.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's you know, similar to like lupus things in people, mm-hmm. although it tends to be, you know, very focal, usually just around the nose area.
All right. I'll do that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Diane, for calling. Appreciate it. And Corey in Cudahy is next. Hi, Corey.
Good afternoon, Larry. Great show.
Thank you.
You know, I recently had to have my 11-and-a-half-year-old German Shorthair put down, which was
aww.
A very
ooh.
Hard experience, because he was really a loyal family member. And
yeah.
We actually got him from a Humane Society, which even made him more special.
Yeah.
But my question is, he, in his last few days, he had hip dysplasia, so it made it really hard for him to even go outside. I had to actually carry him at 60 pounds downstairs to get him to go outside, and then
yeah.
he couldn't even hold himself up. But is that breed of dog typically for that age, is that something that you see more often in that type of dog? Or
yeah, any large breed dog is predisposed to having arthritic changes. Hip dysplasia is one of those things that we see as an inherited problem. That's why many breeders will have their dams and sires checked for it. There's some testing that can be done to help try to get it out of a line of dogs if there is a problem with it. You've got your dog from the shelter. You don't know anything about the background, but you know, that's the big problem with sometimes getting a dog from a shelter is they have an unknown history and you don't know about their background, or maybe why he was sent to the shelter. It could be because he did have bad hips and breeder didn't want him. So. Yeah.
I would tell anybody that if for the amount of time we had him with us, that, I mean, if you can take an animal and give him a better home.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that yeah. we would
well,
do that again in a heartbeat.
All of my pets are rescued, except for one, which was, you know, I've got him kind of as a retired dog, but, and I would go no other way. Part because I don't want to have to raise a puppy again. And so getting an adult, you know, slightly used dog is definitely, you know, makes life interesting, because you never know kind of what's going to pop up behaviorally sometimes, and it's often a pleasant surprise to see how they turn out. I'm so sorry about your loss. You know, big thing things with hips. Keep them skinny. They're going to do better if they're kept slender. Keep that muscle up. So even dogs with hip dysplasia benefit from exercise. And there's lots of places where you can go with dogs that have arthritis like this, that are, you know, pools for dogs and physical therapy places where they can have an underwater treadmill to help keep their muscles up. Talk to the veterinarian about using something like a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory if the dog's body can handle it. They have to have normal liver and kidney function and be able to tolerate it. Joint supplements, glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, and even diets meant for joints that are prescription diets are very helpful and can add lots of years to an arthritic dog's life.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling, Corey. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Kathleen in Fifield has done just that. So let's go to Kathleen. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Hi, Sandy. I'm calling regarding my 15-year-old cat.
Mm-hmm.
It's a male. Last April, he had suddenly stopped eating and drinking not very much either. I took him to the vet, and she alluded to a pancreatic problem.
Mm-hmm.
She prescribed Pred for him. We started out with the full dosage and worked down. And he's now been on a quarter pill for quite a while. I'm concerned he has a personality change.
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned about joints, this particular medication. I don't know for sure if it's something, I'm just looking for another opinion, if he might need this forever.
Yeah, yeah. This is a tough case to be in because I don't know what lab work your cat has had done. Pancreas problems in cats are something that we are recognizing can it presents very differently than pancreatitis in dogs. And it's sometimes difficult to diagnose because the symptoms can be quite vague at times. In dogs, it's usually abdominal pain and vomiting and they going off feed and associated with, you know, getting into the trash or having a big high fatty meal or something. Cats, it's just one of these really vague things that can come on. But there's some special testing that can be done through a gastrointestinal lab down in Texas now that makes us, as veterinarians, have a little bit easier job trying to figure out what's going on. I'm concerned that your veterinarian put your cat on prednisone, and I'm wondering if they're thinking there's something else going on, like inflammatory bowel disease or something else that could be why they've got your kitty on a steroid. And because typically we wouldn't be putting a cat with pancreatitis on a steroid. So I am really hesitant to make a lot of comments on this, except the fact that cats as a species tend to tolerate steroids a lot better than humans and dogs do. We don't see as the severe side effects as much. But anytime we've got long-term use of a medication, I think it's important for the owner to understand the disease process that's going on and ask why. Why do I have to have my cat on this all the time? And what kind of side effects should I be looking for? You know, in dogs, we'll see drinking more, urinating more, thin hair, sometimes bladder infections and skin infections and so on. Cats may not see anything like that at all. But, yeah, I think you need to go back to your veterinarian and say, what actually is the diagnosis? Okay. Then call me back the next time I'm on and we can talk a little bit more.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much, Kathleen. Joanne in Jacksonport, it's your turn. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. So nice to talk to you, Sandy.
You're welcome.
This isn't exactly health, although it could be indirectly. We are going to have to fly our dog when we go to visit our daughter way down in Phoenix this winter. And I'm really nervous about this, mm-hmm. and I've heard that there are pet-friendly airlines, but we're not having much luck.
Okay.
And I wondered, this is a hard question, I know, and she's a Jack Russell. She would probably freak out forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they they say, from what I understand, don't even tranquilize them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I assume that flying the dog, you're not going to be taking her on board with her. She's not small enough to fit under the seat.
No, if we'd gotten a short-legged kind, we probably could have squished her in.
Okay, okay. Yeah, because I do have a family with a Jack Russell that has been going back and forth for years down to Arizona. A few things to think about with flying your dog. Number one is if it's going in the baggage area, there are temperature embargoes. If it's, you know, too hot this time of the year, it's, you know, we're pretty lucky that its temperatures are pretty mild, but if it's over 80 degrees, they can refuse to take you. And so if they're going to be landing and it's going to be over 80 degrees there, they may not allow you to have the dog go in the airplane. And so now you've got the issue of what do? You're at the airport with the dog. So really be watching the weather carefully and have a backup plan. Probably won't be as big of a problem come winter time, but you may need to have your veterinarian write something for cold adaptation. Traveling in winter when it's going to be lower than 30, 40 degrees, you will have to sign a piece of paper that says that your dog can tolerate being turned into a popsicle, because if it gets left on the runway or in a cold area, they need to be able to be cold adapted. And I've signed that for many dogs that I know have long hair and it's not a big deal. Little dog like this, I'm a little reluctant to sign something. So be a weather watcher and have flexible travel plans. Yes, you're right about not sedating the dog. We know that the number one reason why dogs die, why flying, is usually the drugs that veterinarians or owners have given their dogs. It lowers their blood pressure, you know, and they can cause them to vomit, and they can't get away from it, and they're not being observed. So, you know, be really careful with that. Sounds like you've got lots of time, though, to be able to get your dog used to being in a crate. Bring it in, have it become a piece of furniture in your house, throw treats in it, let them sleep in it, start taking your dog for car rides. Take it in. I know this sounds weird, and I'm probably going to get in trouble from like places like Home Depot, but put the dog in the crate and put it in a cart and go push it around Home Depot. It sounds just like an airport with the announcers going over and kind of the noises and things. And a lot of pets get used to that if you can, you know, make it nice and comfortable for them that way. But yeah.
Okay.
Good luck.
And how long are you going to be gone, Joanne?
Well, it just depends. We kind of leave it open. We're hoping a while.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, because if it was going to be a short trip, I'd say find a neighbor to take care of your dog or take him to a boarding kennel. They'd be happier there. Yeah.
Good luck. Thank you very much. Debbie in Schofield, your turn. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
And Dr. Sandy, it's a pleasure talking to you.
Well, that's great. I'm curious to hear what your question is.
It's kind of a quirky behavior that my Maine Coon cat displays, and I'm just wondering if it's a breed thing that they do or if it's just the cat thing. That what we're finding is he enjoys taking personal items of yours. In one case, it was a couple dollar bills that I had on my nightstand, and likes to take them to his water dish, get them wet, and then bring them back to the front door for you.
Whoa. Mm. Okay.
And many times I find at lunch that he will go and take toys and drop them off at the back door. That's the door I usually come into when I'm home for lunch. And it's like he's presenting me with something he's real happy about. And just wondering, is that something that Maine Coons do, or is it a cat behavior?
Well, presenting the owner with gifts, and sometimes it's things not so nice, like dead mice and things like that, is a fairly normal cat behavior. And so it's not just a Maine Coon thing. We do see that all the time. The dunking the dollar bills in the water is weird. Now, I had a cat that liked to drop things in the toilet and just watch them float or whatever, and he'd bat at them. And the worst case, I had a pair of Mickey Mouse ears from Disney World, and he carried those in and dropped them in the toilet, and we had drowned ears and, you know, floating. But that's a very strange one, dipping it in the water. Well, I know a lot of Maine Coons really do like water. And so as a breed, you may see them, you know, spend more time kind of, you know, playing in the bathtub or batting at water and things like that. But, you know, the gifts, just, you know,
that's pretty common,
and, you know, just that's very nice.
Yeah.
You know, he just
it
is
really not, it's not a problem at all. We just thought it was really interesting that he seems to take pride in, you know, bills. And in one particular case, it was my contact lens, so now I don't leave case and I don't leave that out anymore. But he loves, if you have a piece of paper on the floor, you best pick it up quickly. Or he's off with it and dunking it into water.
Okay. Enjoy him.
Thanks, Debbie. Oh, boy. Kathy and Serona, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. Sandy, this is an odd question, perhaps, but I haven't been able to really get an answer for it. My dog is, his mother was 95% wolf hybrid.
Okay.
And his father was a shepherd Rottweiler. And needless to say, he's delightful. His name is Ziggy. He's an indoor dog. He's about 130 pounds. He's about 38 inches tall at the shoulder. And he's got an irregular heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And he is so cat-like, I suppose it would inspire the question, is it the diet? Because he's partly of a wild animal, should I be concerned with the taurine in his diet like you would be for a cat?
Yeah, cats are unique in that they need taurine in their diet, as taurine is an amino acid, and cats being carnivores have several amino acids that they require, and the only way they can get them is through ingestion of meat. Dogs, on the other hand, are able to manufacture their own taurine with the basic ingredients that are in other foods, including some vegetarian diets that dogs may be able to tolerate quite well.
And wolves?
Pardon me?
And wolves?
Wolves are no different. They're a canid, and so they can have a varied diet as well, and they're not strict carnivores in the true sense that cats are.
Okay.
So although we do see sometimes taurine issues in dogs, it tends to be more of a genetic problem. I'm not sure what's causing your dog's irregular heartbeat. I'm sure that your veterinarian has probably done an electrocardiogram, an EKG. May want to be getting a specialist to actually have a look at your dog. And there are cardiologists for dogs available. We've got a couple of them at the veterinary school that see patients like this all the time. And the other thing that may be helpful is having a look at your dog's heart muscle as well. If we're concerned about some type of dietary issue being the problem, cardiomyopathy or heart muscle disease can be diagnosed via doing what's called an echocardiogram, which is an ultrasound of the heart. So rather than just live with it or trying to do your own supplementation, I think it's time to get maybe some lab work done. You can check taurine levels, but an EKG and maybe an echocardiogram are in order for your pooch.
Okay, well, I wasn't even aware that you could have a cardiologist, and my vet didn't really suggest much. He wasn't really concerned. And he is 2 now, and he doesn't really have any real major male behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
But I considered I should get him neutered, which is the right thing to do. He's an indoor dog, so it's not really like he's going to get out the dogs pregnant. But
no, but still, just from the behavior standpoint, lifting their leg and marking in the house, being more aggressive with other boy dogs when he's out and about, roaming if he does get out.
He's good. I have 2 other male dogs, and we don't have any.
Okay.
They're neutered.
Okay.
But I am just, to neuter him would be probably the right thing to do, and yet with the heart dysfunction, that just really kind of makes me nervous. So.
Right, and anesthesia may be perfectly safe if he's got a minor problem. So get him checked out, see what's up, and then you can make some decisions regarding anesthesia.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Kathy. Joe in Oconomowoc, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I have a question. I have a 15-year-old golden retriever. She's been diagnosed in July with mega esophagus,
mm-hmm.
and then that developed into some aspiration pneumonia.
Oh,
that
boy.
Has been cleared up, and then I feed her on the elevated, elevator, so the food, goes down, and she's been fine. She just got back into having the pneumonia. It just came up in, like, one day.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this something... I know the vet has checked for, like, the myasthenia gravis, and she was negative for that. Checked her thyroid.
Yep.
He did the whole barium thing, so I'm pretty confident in the diagnosis.
Right.
Is there any other, anything on the, out there that's different that I haven't come across yet?
No, it sounds like you've got a vet that's right on the ball. And unfortunately, this is something that we do see in dogs. What mega esophagus is the esophagus is the tube that connects the mouth to the stomach that runs through the chest cavity. And it's a muscular tube that helps push the food down into the stomach. And instead, this is just a big flaccid tube and the food just sits in there. And when the dog puts its head down, rests, does anything where it's able to get some of this food, extending back up into the mouth again, they may inhale it, and thus they get aspiration pneumonia by inhaling some of the food. best things you can do, you've already ruled out the common causes that may be treatable causes. The other thing is, you know, make sure that you've ruled out something like Addison's disease. I'm sure your vet, if they did complete lab work and were looking for everything else, that's one of those oddball things that we can see. Addison's is an adrenal gland problem that can be diagnosed with some special testing as well. And they've done chest x-rays, they've done everything, they've, you know, so there's, they can't find any reason. Feed your dog from an elevated position. Look at changing the texture of the food that you're using. Every dog's different. Some do better with the dry, you know, the dry food that's just moist and it's kind of chunky. Some do better with more of a milkshake consistency. And every dog's going to be a little bit different. But unfortunately, this is the number one reason why these dogs die, is they get aspiration pneumonia over and over again. And
well, I'm just wondering, you know, at this point, you know, it's pretty hard to just get her through that. I mean, I'm kind of have some medical background, so I put up with it, but it was a, you know, and then she was nebulized 3 times a day. And there was quite a bit of care, not that I wasn't willing to go through it, but, you know, she is 15, and now I'm like, do we start this process again, or, you know, is this a good time to, like, put them down?
Only you can decide that, but I can just tell you that, you know, having this problem, you will likely need to be making that decision. She's going to be having probably a bout of pneumonia that's going to be the end of her at some point. And when that's going to happen, I don't know.
Who knows?
Yeah. And, you know, you may be able to get her through this one, and it could happen again next week. So you're wise to be thinking about it. But, you know, I can't answer when it's going to be the right time for your dog. You know her better than anybody.
Good luck. Thank you.
Another course of antibiotics, would that be the next step then?
Yeah, I mean,
obviously she's not going to get rid of this pneumonia on her own.
Right, and she may be off and on antibiotics for the rest of her life.
Thanks for calling, Joe, and good luck to you. Appreciate it. Pat in Black Creek, it's your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, a little cold today, but otherwise I'm fine. A little hoarse, a little hoarseness here. What can we do for you today?
I've got a 5-year-old Doberman Pinscher. She's a female. She's been spayed. And it started a couple of months ago. She started having a urine incontinence problem when she's sleeping. You know, we thought it might be psychosomatic because I was traveling a lot, and we thought that might just have an effect on it. It kind of comes and goes. And anyway, we did some research online, and they said that that was kind of common in spayed females as they get older in life. But I brought her to the vet this morning, and the vet prescribed Proin, P-R-O-I-N, 50 milligrams, and recommended a dose twice a day, every 12 hours. And I've got some questions about that. I mean, is she going to have to stay on that then for the rest of her life?
Oh, what a good topic to talk about, because, you know, it is common, and this should not dissuade anyone from having their dog spayed. But if you look at, you know, human females, you know, people that have gone through menopause or, you know, older women, that's why they sell so many Depends pads and all those things on the market. What we've done when we've spayed a dog is basically thrown them into surgically induced menopause. Their ovaries and uterus are gone. And in some dogs, depending on how deep they sleep, where their bladder's positioned and so on, especially if they're going, they've just had a lot of exercise, they drank a lot, their bladder's full, they lay down, they go into a deep sleep, some of this urine may trickle out. If your dog is overweight, get the weight off of her, because that extra abdominal fat will help push on the bladder as well and can cause them to be a little leaky. But the two ways that this is treated, number one, make sure that your dog doesn't have any underlying medical problems that could be making her make more urine, such as diabetes or kidney disease or anything like that. And so getting a urine sample checked, a little blood work done, is going to make sure that your dog is healthy and happy. If a clean bill of health is given, the two drugs that are used, one of them is this Proin, which is called phenylpropanolamine, used to be on the market for people. It got taken off the market, and the drug that it was, name that it was known as, is Dexatrim. It was a diet pill for people. And if you read the fine print, it said, you know, it can cause urinary retention. Well, it didn't cause dogs to have problems with losing their appetite, but it would cause them to have a tighter bladder sphincter to allow them to hold their urine back. And so that we use it more for the side effects. The reason why it got pulled off the market in people is that a lot of people were having strokes and running into problems with it. It can cause hypertension and high blood pressure. And for dogs, it's typically not a problem until they become a senior citizen. And when they start getting older, I worry about that drug as the drug to use for controlling urine leaking. But for young dogs, have normal blood pressure, no problem at all with using it. It is going to be probably for the rest of her life. So she'll need to be on it 1 to 2 times a day. And most, you know, sometimes even 3 times a day is necessary. The other drug that can get used is one that's called DES or estrogen. And it's a low dose of estrogen. It has its own unique side effects. It can suppress the bone marrow. So we have to make sure that we periodically get blood work done on these dogs to make sure that their bone marrow is fine. I've seen no cases of where I could confirm that the drug was causing this in my entire career, but that is a drug that uses used less frequently, use an induction phase usually once a day for about a week, and then you get into once a week or sometimes even less frequently. That's a little bit easier for some owners to be able to give their dogs. So I think you can go either way right now. They both have their pros and cons, and your veterinarian happens to like this Proin, which is just fine. So she's going to be on it forever.
All right. Thanks, Pat. Thank you very much for calling. And Andrea in River Falls, your turn. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. Good morning. Good
morning.
I have a question. I have a 2-year-old foxhound coonhound, mm-hmm. and I already understand that this is a dog that shouldn't really be in a city dog, but he kind of is.
Okay.
And I've had him since a puppy, and he's neutered. But recently, in the last 5 months, he's been displaying aggression toward other dogs.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter what kind of dog it is. And it started with on leash, and now it's off leash, and it's just to the point where he can't really be around any sort of dog that he doesn't already know from when he was a child, like a little puppy.
Okay, okay. Yeah, I mean, this is something that it can be very frustrating, especially if you want to have a social life with your dog. And, you know, what's triggering this? I'm not sure whether he's territorial, whether it's fear-related due to lack of socialization, but it sounds like he had friends when he was growing up. What I would be recommending is that when, you know, aggression is a very serious behavior problem, and rather than just giving you some pat advice over the phone, you need to get a diagnosis. And to be able to do that, you need to work with someone like an applied animal behaviorist who can watch your dog, look at subtle body language cues. It's helpful to work with someone professional like this because they often have therapy dogs, dogs that aren't going to flinch or do anything when your dog's present, and they're able to see how your dog reacts, you know, while their dog just sits there and ignores them. But it can, you know, maybe that you're going to have some lifestyle changes that, you know, he's going to be only around certain dogs at certain times under certain circumstances, and then gradually expand his territory as he gets better and better. But I think you need professional help with this, and be really careful. Make sure he's on a leash all the time, and, you know, not allowed to just roam and run free, which, boy, having a hound in the city is really difficult.
Very hard. Good luck, Andrea. Thanks very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Mike in Langlade County, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning.
I would like to ask your guest, I'm in the market for a new dog, mm-hmm. and I'm going to get a female. Is it true that neutering a female before her first heat period will significantly extend her life? And then would you also please discuss the merits, costs, and the length of layup time for the dog between the more or less old-fashioned spaying procedure where all the organs are removed versus something laser sort of tubal ligation?
Okay, good questions. The spaying is a procedure where ovaries and uterus are removed. And if you do it prior to them having the first heat cycle, their body has not undergone any hormonal changes. And the big problem that we'll see in dogs that have had a couple of heat cycles is it increases their risk of developing breast cancer to the point where once they're over two, spaying or neutering, spaying them is not going to change the incidence of breast cancer. So the damage is already done. And, you know, breast cancer in dogs can be malignant. It may be benign. Sometimes we'll see mixed tumors, but that is a huge concern. The other thing that we run into troubles with is in intact females is them developing a uterine infection called a pyometra. Again, quite common in elderly dogs and can be a medical emergency and could shorten their life if it's not treated and it's an emergency spay at that point to remove the infected uterus. We do see ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, although it's not as common as these other things that I've just mentioned. So spaying is going to decrease some of these health risks, and that's going to extend her life. Problem, though, remember, spayed dogs, their caloric needs change. They need to be on about 20% fewer calories than their intact friends. And so making sure that you don't allow her to get overweight. Obesity is one of the leading causes of decreased life expectancy. We know that dogs that are kept slender will live about 15% longer. So get her spayed and keep her slender, and now you're going to have a dog that's going to live a lot longer. Now, you mentioned having something like a tubal ligation done, similar to like a vasectomy. I have one owner that insists on having his dogs vasectomized, and both dogs that were vasectomized ended up having prostate disease because they still had all the hormones there. They just were infertile, but still had all the hormonal changes. So doing a tubal ligation on the dog, you're still going to have all the problems with an infected uterus, ovarian cancer, breast cancer, all those things, which is going to shorten their life. Lasers can be done to do general surgery, though, and we do it fairly commonly for like declaws in cats. It helps cut down on some of the superficial bleeding of some of the blood vessels. We know that for cats that are declawed, they tend to bounce back a little bit faster. They're up and walking, a lot less painful. Whether that's true with other soft tissue surgeries using the laser, I'm not aware of it. But, that's something to make sure that you discuss this with your veterinarian to make sure that they have the skills to be able to use a laser. Just because they got the toys doesn't mean that it's going to be the best way to have your dog spayed. The good old fashioned open them up with a scalpel blade and, you know, proceed to remove everything sterilely is, you know, been done forever and is safe and easy procedure, a week or 10 days of rest, and they should be back to their old self again.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. Jim in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a first-time caller. I have a question in regard to a 13-week-old yellow lab puppy that we just got. She has extremely weepy eyes to the point where it stains down close to her nose.
Okay.
And we've talked to the vet about it, and we're getting all kinds of different information on what it may or may not be, and just wondering what your thoughts were. And I do have a follow-up if possible.
Okay. Well, if her eyes aren't red or irritated and it's just normal tears that are overflowing, question is it because she's got obstructed tear ducts for whatever reason that doesn't allow the tears to flow down the ducts and out through the nose as they normally should? Or does she have something that's irritating her eyes that are causing more tearing, such as extra eyelashes or eyelids that are rolling in or rolling out, causing some problems? If your veterinarian is unable to determine the cause for this, you may need to be visiting a veterinary ophthalmologist. And there's several of them around the state now, and I know your vet probably has a favorite that they could refer you to. But so there's some simple tests that your vet can do to look for extra eyelashes. They can put some stain in the eye to make sure that the tear ducts are patent, that it flows out through the nose appropriately. And so having a good eye exam done by your veterinarian may solve your problem right there, and they may be able to find something that can be treated easily. But, sometimes, I know I'm not comfortable doing eyelid surgery. It's been a long time. I use my colleagues at the vet school, the ophthalmologists there, but there are several others around the state as well.
Is there any truth to their tear ducts not being fully developed for a period of time?
No, they should be by the time that you adopt the dog. The eyelids are closed when the puppies are born, and they open their eyes, usually open at about 2 weeks of age, and by then they should have functional tear ducts. And so the puppy that's 13 weeks of age should have normal functioning tear ducts. So something's wrong with your dog. And have you talked to the breeder at all to find out if there's other puppies in the litter that have problems like this?
I have not talked to the breeder yet. No, we've been taking this through our vet.
Yeah, I think I'd call the breeder because, you know, a reputable breeder is going to be just as curious as you are because this may be something that if it's running in the line, there could be problems that they're not going to want to have to face in the future and may be able to help you financially. If they are a reputable breeder, they might even take this on themselves or help you out with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Do I have time for a follow-up question?
Okay, a quick one.
Okay, yes. In regard to food, we have talked to all different pet stores, veterinaries, and they all give us a different answer when we ask about the type of food a puppy should be on. Some of them are saying that one food through their entire life is sufficient. Others say that for this type of breed, it should be a large breed, slow growth food off the get-go, and then change it later on. We're just getting all kinds of conflicting information.
Oh, you know, it's just kind of like the human world, too. I mean, eat butter, eat margarine, eat this, eat that, you know, don't eat this. And we've got the same issues in the pet food world. Just go down the pet food aisle, and there are so many brands of food out there. I think, in general, my recommendation, I'm going to go with what your last comment was, large breed growth formula. And they're designed for large breed dogs to help cut down on some of the orthopedic diseases that can occur by pushing them to grow too quickly in those early bone growing months. So that's what I like. And then once they get to be a little bit older, 7, 8, 9, 10 months of age, then getting them switched over to an adult formula and take it from there. I'm not brand loyal. You need to look at whether your dog likes it, whether it meets your needs as a consumer, where you can buy it, the cost of it, and so on. You may want a holistic diet. You may want one that's, you know, certain preservatives or lack of preservatives. You know, whatever you choose, just make sure that it does say on the bag, large breed growth formula, and I think you can't go wrong.
All right.
Very well. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks, Jim, for calling. And Lewis in Oak Creek, your turn. Hi, Lewis.
Hi, Larry. Sandy, I have a 3-year-old AKC standard poodle that has a left ear with incurable fungus. I've been through 3 vets and 2 groomers, and it just can't be cured.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, a few things. Number one is, you know, making sure that the ear is being thoroughly examined. And that
is twice in August and again just a week ago was sedated and totally cleaned out.
Okay. And she has a normal eardrum, no ruptured eardrum, any problems that way?
He didn't see anything wrong with the eardrum. He went down to the eardrum twice.
Okay.
And cleaned out everything, and like a week later, the fungus is starting again.
Okay.
And I'm shooting Animax in there at a very high rate.
Yeah, and, you know, treating a yeast infection topically may help, but I find I have better luck treating with systemic antifungal drugs, meaning tablets that you give orally.
Well, he tried 2, I don't know the names right now, of them. The first drug did not work. The second, the dog stopped eating after 2 weeks. It took it for about 2 weeks, and then it just refused to eat.
Yeah, and it can sometimes cause GI upset. But that works usually, but you're looking at about 3 to 4 weeks of treatment. Usually a month of treatment is necessary. I worry that your dog may have some underlying allergies. Even though only one ear is affected, we do see that happen. I know it sounds kind of weird, but yeast infections, yeast are a normal inhabitant of the ear, and sometimes when we have a problem with the chemistry of the ear, it's too warm, it's a little moist because the dog has some allergies, or in the case of a poodle, all that extra hair that they tend to have in their ear can predispose them to having yeast overgrowth. So, you know, maybe be looking into allergy screening if there's a problem that way. I know what our dermatologist does in chronic cases like this is they use the video otoscope. They go down in there and have a look, make sure that the eardrum is truly intact. If the eardrum's broken, then getting a CT scan done of the head. Sometimes we're doing middle ear flushes to be able to clean all the debris out, and then appropriate oral medications to be able to get it under control. It can become a intermittent lifetime problem, and I don't have any other solutions for you except, you know, I'm glad that you've got a vet that's on the ball that's sedating her or knocking her out to be able to have this done, because there's nothing worse than trying to examine a dog's ear in an awake state when they're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Is it possible to remove the ear hair permanently?
No. Okay. And that's, I mean, I've had people throw like a product like Nair down their dog's ears, totally burn the ear. Don't do that. You know, lasering off hair, is it possible? I don't know anybody that's doing it. And that may be something that I can talk to one of my dermatologist buddies and find out and come back to you on the next show. Or you can contact me at the veterinary school and maybe I'll be able to give you some more information on that. I'm not aware of anybody that's doing it, but boy, wouldn't that be nice? Laser hair removal for these dogs. And that's maybe in the future.
Mm. Or maybe here.
Maybe, yeah.
Now, I've noticed that the eye, on the left eye, is not exactly looking like the right eye anymore. Do you think that is connected with the fungal, or am I just kind of...
When you say it doesn't look like it, is the eyelid droopy?
Yeah,
okay.
And not quite as open.
Okay, my guess is then if you've got that going on, you've got a pretty serious ear infection. There's a nerve that runs right by the middle ear cavity called the sympathetic nerve, and when that gets affected, and there's also a nerve that's called the facial nerve that supplies motor movement to the face, and when those two nerves get irritated by middle ear disease, you can see neurologic impairment, either a condition called Horner's syndrome, where you get drooping of the eyelid, change in pupil size, or facial nerve paralysis, where the whole face droops on one side and the dog's unable to blink. That sets off a big alarm. Your dog needs to have a CT scan done of its head to be able to look for middle ear disease. It might be that it's being missed.
Would I have to take it to Madison, then to the vet school?
That would probably be one of the easier places to come. I'm not sure if any of the other referral centers in the area have CT capability, but that might be in order, setting up an appointment to have that looked into.
And what kind of a price tag are we talking about, something like that?
I would guess anesthesia, CT, derm workup, cultures, evaluation, probably $600 to $800.
Mm-hmm. And that still wouldn't be a cure. That would just be knowledge.
Be knowledge and perhaps secure if they can get to the bottom of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And if they can get to the bottom of it, it'd be worth $600 or $800.
It might be. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support.
Talking Your Pet's Health now with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Glad to have you listening in. And Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, you were telling me about some cat ice cream.
Well, it's been on the market for dogs, you know, for a long time, called Frosty Paws. And in fact, I bought some for my dogs the other day. And one of them, he must have got an ice cream headache because he swallowed it down and then just stood there like, oh my, and then barfed it all up again. So I was like, that's it. We're not buying this anymore for him. But remember, it's not human ice cream. This is probably, I would assume that the cat stuff is most likely a soya milk or something like that. That's a little easier to digest than dairy products. But it's called Cool Claws, okay? And I just bring it up that if you're going to be doing a diet change in your cat, go about it slowly to just plunk one of these things down in front of the cat and have them eat it. You may have some accidents to clean up. Really pay attention closely to, you know, the litter box for a few days to decide whether this is something that's worth feeding your cat.
And, you know, we used to feed Frosty, our cat, well, when you finish the ice cream and there's a little left in the bottom of the bowl, you know.
Yeah.
She would love to lick that vanilla ice cream.
Yeah, I remember it's got sugar and milk, and some cats are dairy intolerant, but if they tolerate it, you know, big rules, Sawchuk's rules of feeding table food are, if your pet's overweight, don't do it. If they mooch, don't do it, you know. Or if it gives them diarrhea or upset tummy, don't do it. But, you know, in this case, it's something that we can maybe, you know, give our cats something nice if they can tolerate it. Yeah.
George in Richland Center, your turn. Hi, George. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a collie, a 3-year-old, very nice dog, great personality, playful. My only issue with a collie is we live on a in a farm on a dead-end road. And I kind of wish, instead of barking at squirrels and deer and whatnot, that he'd bark if, you know, a car drove up or a person or something like that. But he just kind of wags his tail when anybody drives up and greets them.
Yeah, you know. And
in a lot of ways, that's a good thing.
That is, you know, it is. Because you've got, you know, a dog that, I mean, you can probably train him to alert you and still do that kind of behavior.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm not sure whether you can set it up where, does he speak on command? If you ask him to speak, will he bark on command?
No.
Okay, well, he's not a very vocal dog. And so maybe genetically, you just got a dog that's not going to be a really good watchdog. But collies are herding dogs. And, mm-hmm. you know, herding dogs aren't necessarily going to be real, you know, watchful of danger and be alerting. They want to just keep things all on the same on the property. So he's probably, you know, just not in his genes. And accept him and love him for as he is. But if you want him to bark, you can try to teach him to bark on command and then, you know, ask him to bark when somebody's coming up and kind of put it on cue where, you know, a friend's pulling in the driveway, speak, speak, and he starts learning that I speak when the car's pulling in, I get treats, this is wonderful. Could backfire, though. I lived with a collie for a number of years before he died of lymphoma, and he was a barker at the doorbell and so on, and it can be quite annoying. So count your blessings. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, George.
Thank you.
And let's take some more calls. John in Germantown, I think it's your turn next. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. A wonderful program again.
Thanks.
We have a dog, a family dog. It's 15. It's a lab mix, and it's fixed. But it has developed, I think, according to the vet, like arthritis in the spinal area.
Mm-hmm.
And we were given a medication for it. And what we've done, my mother has done, is she's gone to giving that medication to the dog every other day instead of every day.
Mm-hmm.
And giving aspirin, adult buffered aspirin in the other days, and it makes the dog very lethargic.
Yeah,
Is that typical? Should we lower the dose on that, the aspirin?
Well, I'm really hesitant to have you use aspirin in your dog, although aspirin is... can be safe. Many dogs will get gastric ulcers and GI irritation from it compared to some of the prescription drugs that are out there for dogs now that are a little safer for long-term use. There's many of them available on the market. Some of them are once-a-day drugs. Some are twice-a-day drugs. But I think you'd be better off using one of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that are prescription from your veterinarian rather than trying to use an over-the-counter product. And you're obviously seeing that he's not tolerating it if he's depressed and probably has some tummy ache when he's getting something like that.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Other than just using pain medication, in a case like this, your dog may benefit from some of the alternative care modalities, such as chiropractic care. I think in the veterinary world, we have to call it spinal manipulative therapy, or acupuncture. And there are lots of vets around now that are becoming certified in both of these programs. And it's, you know, it may be able to cut down on the drug use that you need to have your dog on to be comfortable and give your dog some pain relief as well.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Yeah. Very helpful.
Thank you very much for calling, John. Diane in West Allis. Hi to you.
Hi. I have five cats, four females and one male. They're all fixed in front decod. My male will back up into things and spray just a little bit. I mean, I think it's just a few drops sometimes.
Yeah.
How do I stop that?
Yeah, urine marking in cats is... typically done when they're socially stressed. I kind of equate it to us with the can of spray paint. You know, where do you see graffiti? Where there's crowding and so on, and where life might be a little more stressful. And cats don't know how to work a spray paint can. So he's leaving his scent behind as a way of marking his territory. A few things to consider. Number one, you know, five cats in the household, it may be that that's a little more than the space can tolerate. I mentioned earlier in the show, expanding their territory. Look at, you know, going up with cat trees and ramps and things like that so that he may not feel like he's in such a crowded area.
Okay.
Multiple feeding stations, multiple litter boxes as well is really helpful. Clean the areas where he's marked because they may go back and remark in those areas. Especially, I mean, if he's marking in areas where he may be able to see cats outside, putting up blinds, contact paper on the windows, you know, something like that, so he can't see the other cats that may be antagonizing him outdoors as well. It may not be one of his girlfriends in the house that's doing it.
But he also does get to go outside sometimes.
Okay.
So, I don't know, he loves it out there. But most of my cats are the kind where you can tie them out on a leash.
Uh-huh, yeah.
He likes to be loose, and he sneaks out when I don't let him, so I...
Yeah.
Pretty much let them.
Yeah, and you know, and I was going to say, if you let them be an outside cat, sometimes they'll confine their marking to outdoors rather mm-hmm. than in the house. I've mentioned earlier in the show a product called Feel Away or Comfort mm-hmm. Zone. Plugging mm-hmm. that in may help. There are other medical management tools that involve psychoactive drugs for cats, although I don't think you're probably at that level yet. And remember, none of these drugs are licensed for cat use. We're using them off-label. They're human drugs that we typically use, and mm-hmm. they all have their own side effect profile, so we have to be really careful with using it. So expand his territory in the house as much as you can, clean the areas, plug in some Feel Away, and you know, hopefully he can be de-stressed a little bit.
Okay. Can I ask you one something else real fast?
Sure.
I have a dog who was put on, I think it's called Prevacox.
Okay.
And that is, I mean, she's supposed to take, well, the amount she takes, it would be like $75 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And is there something that's more reasonable, or because I've looked online too, and my vet will not sign the prescription for me to buy it online?
Okay.
So is there something that's more reasonable, because she's going to be on this forever?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of these non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
And you may want to try adjusting the dose to find if that a lower dose gives you just as much relief. I'm surprised that your veterinarian won't allow an outside prescription. If I went to my human physician
mm-hmm.
and they said the only place you can get your drugs filled is in our hospital pharmacy and no place else, I would probably run away from that doctor and say, I never want to see you again.
I
want to go wherever I want to go. And as veterinarians, this is kind of a new world for us. I know it sounds kind of strange, but we've never been in this position up until just a few years ago of having outside pharmacies.
Yeah.
For my own patients, I am very happy to write outside prescriptions. But I want to make sure that the dog is tolerating the drug well. I may refuse to refill it if I haven't seen you for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, making sure that you are keeping up with your physical exams. And for dogs that are on these medications, sometimes, you know, getting them in every 6 months for lab work, especially if they're older patients, to make sure that we don't have underlying kidney or liver problems, because these drugs can make those issues worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess a few years back, somebody asked him to do that, and they had a bad experience where supposedly they were writing out using his name for other prescriptions or something.
Well, if you go through most of the online pharmacies now, you can do it via fax, okay?
Yeah.
And so they're not even you're not even handing out a prescription where they can, you know, use that. And I, you know, people just do a fax back, and they put in a request, we fax it, and away we go. Just like I just got a refill myself. Mm. My pharmacist ended up faxing it to my physician. They signed it, and I got my drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
simple as that.
Good luck. Thanks, Diane, for calling. Appreciate it. And, you know, while we're talking about drugs, Rimadyl, somebody asked about Rimadyl and for you to comment on Rimadyl.
Yeah, Rimadyl is one of these drugs just like Prevacox or Meloxicam, Medicam. It's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, goes by the chemical name of carprofen. It's similar to ibuprofen, although much safer than ibuprofen for dogs. You don't want to use ibuprofen in dogs. The therapeutic dose is very close to the toxic dose for causing organ problems. So it's one of our favorites at the veterinary school, probably because it's been around the longest and we're comfortable with it. There are many of them out there, and each dog is an individual. Some of them can tolerate one over another. The downside about Rimadyl is it's usually a twice-a-day drug. Some of these other newer ones that are out are once-a-day, and it makes dosing a little bit easier.
Mary and Nina, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Good afternoon. This is a follow-up on the ear infection problem.
Mm-hmm.
I had the same thing with my Portuguese water dog, and we medicated and deep cleaned for about 6 months. And then the vet decided, you know, suggested that we do that radical surgery on the ear canal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I backed off on that, took him for a second opinion, and the first thing that vet asked was, how did the culture and sensitivity turn out?
Right.
And my first vet had never done a culture insensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
When it was done, they came up, he had some weird combination of a fungus and bacteria from swimming, I guess.
Yeah.
And they came up with the proper medications, and within 3 weeks, it was gone and never came back.
And that's so, thank you for bringing this up. When we're treating ears, especially if there's bacteria present, and it's a chronic problem, or the bacteria are what are called rod-shaped bacteria, which tend to be in the class that are going to have more problems with resistance, like Pseudomonas.
Mm-hmm.
Culturing is just one of those things we do when we're doing our workups. In the former call, they said that it had been diagnosed as a yeast infection. So I have to assume that they did cytology and they found that there wasn't a bacterial problem. It was 100% yeast, which can happen. But, you know, you're right.
It's
if there is bacteria,
point.
You've got to get that culture done, because you just can't throw antibiotics at the ear without knowing exactly what is would be the appropriate antibiotics.
Yeah, thanks.
Right, look for the simple things first, and
right.
then progress
right.
to the more complicated.
You got it. You got
thanks.
It.
Thanks
yep.
a lot.
Thanks, Mary. Thank you for calling. Tom in Superior, hi to you.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I've got a 14-and-a-half-year-old lab mix. She is having problems lately. She hasn't She doesn't want to eat her dog food anymore. I often mix in things like yogurt and stuff like that to get her to eat it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But even that isn't working. She'll eat yogurt and turkey and, you know, I mean, my food right now. But she goes back and forth from having good energy to being really run down. I take her out and I trot her along for maybe a mile every now and then. But the last few days, I mean, she's been the worst that she's been in quite some time. And she, you know, she's not eating her regular food and her energy. She has a hard time even getting up and,
Well, I'm gonna be blunt with you, Tom. You shouldn't have been taking the time to call me. You should be on the phone with your veterinarian right now and saying, I need to set up an appointment for this afternoon to get my dog in to have him checked out. A lab that doesn't want to eat, I mean, most of them, that's, I mean, they, they're, that's their big joy in life is eating. And the fact that your dog is picky, is lethargic, and it's a 14-year-old dog, there's so many issues that could be going on. Needs to have a thorough physical done, probably some lab work as well, to get some answers. And it, you know, hopefully it's not going to be anything serious, but at this point in a dog's life, it very well could be. So you may be making some hard decisions here in the future, but time to get your dog into the vet and have him checked out.
Yeah. All right.
Appointment set up. I'm going to do that.
So. Okay.
Good.
Good.
Good. Thank you very much for calling. You're doing the right thing. Nick in Green Bay. Hello.
I've got a small problem. I've got two dogs, a black lab. He's 3 years old. He's got the perfect hourglass shape. He's super energetic, and I got a little Shih Tzu. And he's just the opposite. He's just a fat little guy.
Uh-huh.
And I feed him the Shih Tzu I feed two cups a day. And the lab I feed two cups a day, but he never eats it. He
okay.
just eats when he wants to. The only problem is I feed the Shih Tzu just two cups a day. And he'll go through that like nothing, and then he'll turn around and go into the lab dish.
Oh, well, you know, that's what you've brought up a few things. Every dog's an individual. A Shih Tzu is a little lap dog who spends its life sitting on the couch, has the metabolism of a slug. Two cups of food is probably, I mean, obviously, way too many calories going in. You need to feed your dog separately. You need to make sure that the Shih Tzu doesn't have access to the lab's food. You know, having a lab that walks away from food, wow, that's unique, too. But, you know, pick the food up afterwards.
Okay.
One thing that your veterinarian can do is do what's called body condition scoring, which is a way of looking at how overweight your dog is and then figure out how much weight they need to lose and calculate out their caloric needs for the day and then convert that into how much dog food to feed.
Okay.
There's a number of low-cal dog foods out there as well as prescription dog foods as well. There's also some new medications. There's a new diet aid for dogs called Slentrol, which is a liquid appetite suppressant for dogs that appears to be very effective at helping
really?
Your dog get lose weight and not be quite as hungry all the time. But there's nothing better than exercise, okay, and fewer calories. And so work on that first.
Exercise all the time.
Yeah.
The only other question I got real quick is he's got fat balls. He's 14 years old.
Uh-huh.
And how dangerous are those, or what type of negative effects will those have on them?
The lipomas, lipoma tumors, is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Yeah, if typically they're not a problem for dogs. They're more of a cosmetic issue. Unless they're located someplace like right on the sternum when they're laying down or in the armpit, it may interfere with movement. But for the most part, they are just there. And once they get one, they'll sometimes get many. And you want to make sure that there's not a different kind of cancer there. We had a Cocker Spaniel in not too long ago that had 13 new lumps. 12 of them were lipomas, which are benign fatty growths. And a new one popped up that felt like a lipoma. It turned out to be a mast cell tumor, which is a malignant tumor. So any new ones need to be checked out and confirm that that's what they are.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. I got to admit, though, real quick, I do feed the Shih Tzu because he's so cute when he sits on it and kind of likes begging for food.
No food, no table food either, because those are hard calories to count.
Hi, Nick. Thanks, Nick. Paul in Duluth, Minnesota. Your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I'm glad I'm able to get in. I believe I talked to your guest last time she was on about my 14-year-old dog. She's a chow mix, and she has never been particularly drooly. I mean, if she's hot or whatever, she'll maybe pant a bit. But the other day, and now the weather is cooler, I was walking her, and I noticed it's like saliva, clear saliva kind of sprinkling down from her muzzle. And the other thing I've noticed is that she sleeps guarding my door, even though she's got a really comfy bed.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed the other day, I got out of bed in my bare feet, and I noticed a kind of a wet spot, and I sniffed it, and it wasn't urine.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if there's anything going on, why she would be producing
drool.
Excess drool. A dental disease, 14-year-old dog could have some pretty cruddy teeth, and sometimes we'll see them drooling if they've got some oral pain and discomfort, or we'll see things like masses in the mouth that can cause drooling. Foreign bodies. I had a dog with a popsicle stick stuck on the roof of its mouth, and I don't know how long it'd been there. We'll get all kinds of weird foreign bodies in the mouth that can be triggering some drooling as well. I had an owner the other day whose dog started drooling profusely. It turned out it picked a toad up. Now, that was just a one-time deal. Not that you've got toads in your house and your dog's being exposed to it, but, you know, anything irritating to the mouth like that, the chemical that the toad secreted caused them to drool. So it comes down to, I sound like a broken record, get your dog into the veterinarian for a good oral exam to see what's going on in there. Mm-hmm. Drooling is one of those things. It could be, you know, something serious, something minor, and we don't know until you start having a look.
All righty.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Paul. Chuck and Adams, your turn. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The question is, I took my dog in, boarded him over the weekend. He's about a two-year-old chocolate lab. And now I get him back. We went to play late last night, and I noticed wasn't barking, and he growls, nothing but air comes out.
Oh, okay. Probably spent.
If he barked too much while he was.
We do see pets get laryngitis, and it's very possible that he just barked his full head off all weekend, had a great time barking at everybody there. Call the boarding kennel and just say, hey, do you remember my lab? Was he pretty noisy while he was there? And hopefully he'll get his voice back. But as long as he's swallowing and he's happy and he's playful and it's just he's a little hoarse, I don't worry about it. But there is a condition that typically affects older labs called laryngeal paralysis, where their vocal cords become paralyzed. These dogs typically don't exercise well. They have a hoarse bark. They pant, and it's hoarse when they're panting as well. And that can be a surgical emergency at times. But it's a young dog. Just went to a boarding kennel. My guess is that it just overdid it. Kind of like me at the last concert I went to, you know.
Okay.
A little hoarse the next day.
Because he hasn't lost any of his, you know, normal playfulness. He still tries to bark. He still tries to growl.
Yeah.
You know, and he's got all the energy he had before, and he still begs just as much as he did.
Okay, well, it sounds like he just overdid it, partying at the kennel. Yeah.
Well, thank you. That puts my mind at rest.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling. You know, Sandy, I promised we'd talk about the talking food bowl as well, and what have we got there?
A new bowl for pets that is called the Chatter Bowl, and you can program it as they walk up to it. It will have your voice talking to the pet. And so what they claim is that, you know, you may want your cat to return throughout the day to hear the message play. You know, as the cat will go over to hear you say, I love you, while it's getting a drink. Me, I think it's going to scare the bejeebies out of the average cat, and it's probably going to avoid the water bowl if every time it walks up to it, there's all of a sudden the owner's voice showing up and you're not there. So I think it's one of those things that you have a better way of spending $25 and just use one of your own dishes rather than buying this. But it is one of those novelty things that's out there, and I know there's going to be people buying it. Yep.
Oh, yeah. Well, it wouldn't be there if they weren't buying
it. That's right.
And the other one, the kitty box or the litter box, that was $300.
$300. And, you know, you could buy a lot of pooper scoopers for $300 and have a cat that's very happy with the litter box.
Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We'll look forward to our next visit. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. We'll be really pleased to have her back, and we'll talk some more about your pet's health. Just to let you know, coming up tomorrow at 11, Kevin Palmer, Tim Tallon, and Christine O'Neill will join us to celebrate National 4-H Week. 4-H is doing some interesting things with families with children whose parents are in Iraq, and we'll learn about that tomorrow. Then Professor Randy Fortenberry, director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute at UW-Madison, will talk with us about bioenergy and some of the cool research that's going on in that area. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.